Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised. Lock your doors. Close the blinds. Change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This podcast is produced and hosted by Chris Carr.
On today's podcast, I'm joined by former U.S. Navy destroyer captain Gene Moran to discuss the Houthi threat in the Red Sea. In this episode, we look at the background of the Houthis, the threat that they pose, and how the U.S. Navy and its allies are dealing with that threat. Then we later on discuss life on a ship during a time of conflict, and we finish up with Gene explaining what more he thinks could be done to counter this threat. Just before we begin, if you're enjoying this podcast, please consider supporting us directly by becoming a Patreon subscriber. All you need to do is just go to patreon.com/secretsandspies, and depending on which level you pick, you'll get a free coaster or coffee cup. And also you'll get access to our Patreon exclusive show, Extra Shot, which comes out twice a month after every espresso martini. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this episode. Take care.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
Hello, G. Moran. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Chris. Good to be here.
It's great to have you on. So for the benefit of our listeners, please can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your career in the U.S. Navy?
Sure. I spent 24 years in the U.S. Navy driving ships and then commanding ships. In the Navy, there's a saying that you're either at sea or in D.C. And so I had multiple Washington tours between my ship tours. At sea, I commanded a cruiser and a destroyer, commanded multi-ship operations in the Mediterranean and Persian Gulf, operated with carriers. Ashore, I worked representing the Navy to Congress in a few different positions at very senior levels. Coordinating for the Secretary and Chief of Naval Operations with Congress.
Fantastic. What were the ships that you commanded? Because the only reason I ask is the only U.S. naval ship I've ever been on was the USS Normandy back in, 1994 when it visited Portsmouth.
Well, I commanded a sister ship. Philippine Sea was CG-58 and also commanded USS Laboon, DDG-58. They share a same number but a different ship class. As life would have it, both ships are in the Red Sea as we speak, operating, and I've been on both ships as they did similar missions previously.
Fantastic. Well, today we're going to talk about the Houthi threat to international shipping and the U.S.-led efforts to counter that threat. So I'll start with a kind of broad question. Why is freedom of movement in the Red Sea important?
Movement of commerce is really what it's all about, and that is a major sea line of communication for shipment of goods. Billions of dollars of goods passed through the Suez Canal, which was brought about as a way to save travel time, having to go around Africa. But that saves about 10 days of transit time if you're traveling from the Far East to Europe. And if you don't have free transit there, that immediately translates to additional costs of those goods.
Indeed. And obviously, we're at a time where costs are already rising because of energy prices and so on. And so those added costs do have a massive knock-on effect. And I think I was even reading just the other day how it's actually having an effect on people even in the Middle East itself with costs and things.
Well, just from the transit costs, for some commercial ships, that may be hundreds of thousands of dollars per day. You know, multiply that by 10 days of transit time by the number of ships. I mean, it is thousands of ships. Most people have very little idea that so much of commerce moves by sea because it's the most cost-effective manner. But obviously, when people are obstructing those transit lanes, it has more localized effect as well. People make decisions to be in the area or not, and you know, it affects lives, it affects local commerce. And it's in this case, it's affecting global commerce.
Yeah. I'll carry on with another broad question. I was thinking about sort of the Middle East and sort of post-Iraq, post-Afghanistan, and obviously the Red Sea itself. What kind of strategic interests do the U.S. and its allies sort of have in that region?
Well, our interests for decades had been in protecting access to oil. The oil posture of the U.S. has changed dramatically in the last couple of decades. With the introduction of fracking and access to oil that was not accessible previously. But in a broader sense, beyond that, what was access to oil as a driver is just the regional stability. It's healthy to have world order where everyone can move around and engage in commerce. Now we have activity that is focused on, I say we, the United States and its allies are focused on activity to prevent the flow of arms and narcotics in the Middle East, which are used for certainly nefarious purposes, and the narcotics are used to fund those nefarious activities. Many would be surprised to know that the Coast Guard has, the U.S. Coast Guard has quite a presence in the Middle East every day, in addition to the naval presence. And that is there specifically because they are expert at interdicting narcotics trafficking.
I did not know that about the Coast Guard. So basically, you're saying you've got U.S. Navy and Coast Guard ships in that air, and they have sort of different skill sets. Is that right?
Yes. And different offensive and defensive capability as well.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Because obviously some Coast Guard ships are quite large. You know, are they former sort of U.S. naval ships, or are they especially commissioned for the Coast Guard?
What's over there now are specific Coast Guard ships. They are not former Navy ships. But if you think about the mission set, you know, a Coast Guard ship would not be doing offensive strike ashore or operating in an integrated air defense mode. They just don't have those sort of weapon systems. They're very skilled at tracking and interdicting narcotics trafficking, but integrated weapon systems is not their strength, and that's not a knock on them. It's just not central to their mission.
Yeah, that makes sense. So how does this sort of conflict with the Houthis affect regional stability?
Well, we have people who are influencing geopolitical scenarios that are not in authorized power. You know, the Houthis are a rebel force. They are not elected. They are trying to regain control. For hundreds of years, they were in control until about the 1960s or so. And in the they were not the Houthis at the time. They were a form of a Shiism, but since the 80s or so, they have established themselves as the Houthis to try to regain power. Mm. Right now, we see parts of Yemen that are controlled and uncontrolled, and the Houthis tend to be in the uncontrolled portions of the country.
Yeah, yeah, and they are considered a proxy of Iran, aren't they?
They are, and they are one of several, and so that certainly causes challenges when trying to figure out how to participate in the world order. You know, we tend to see the military actions and the strikes that are taking place in the last several months, but you know, there's a diplomatic side of the equation as well. There's an intelligence aspect to this, to just be monitoring what's going on. But the economic considerations are real, and it's to every nation's advantage to be able to engage in free commerce.
Indeed. Obviously, there's been a lot kind of going on in the Red Sea with the Houthis. Are you able to kind of give us an overview of what the kind of current situation is, and maybe, if possible, some numbers on some of the sort of drones and things that have been shot down? I certainly believe at least a ship has been sunk. It might be more than that.
Yeah. So that from a U.S. perspective, there's a U.S. battle group, the Dwight D. Eisenhower battle group. I have operated with them on multiple occasions and have overseen the air warfare picture for that battle group in a prior life while I was on active duty. The ships are joined by cruisers and destroyers of that battle group and what are known as independent deployers. There are always a couple of ships that are sort of free floaters that can move between the Persian Gulf, the Gulf of Aden, and the Mediterranean and Red Sea, depending on where the activity might be. We have had an anti-piracy force there for decades now, operating along with allies. In the Red Sea, we are joined by allied ships that have different capabilities. And I do think it's important to recognize that multiple allied partners are trying to participate alongside us. Just because they don't have the same types of ships and capability doesn't mean that they don't have the will. And much like the Coast Guard can integrate in certain military operations, other nations' navies can integrate with us as well. And it does help from a logistics perspective. And sometimes, you know, presence matters. And just being visible to that opponent matters. And so to the degree that those allies are able to multiply our force number, that's helpful. You talk about numbers. You know, we have not seen this sort of activity where so many targets and threats are coming at us at one time. And it's not that we haven't imagined it and haven't trained for it, because we have. And I think we're seeing in the response, the U.S. response, that it's been superb. The success rate in dealing with the threats coming at the U.S. ships, I think, has been spectacular. That's because those ships are trained in a very deliberate manner to deal with very large-scale threats before they ever go into that environment. It doesn't mean that we ever expect to fully see what we're seeing, and we're learning from what we're seeing, because some of it is not quite as expected. The mix of sophistication of the drones, the mixture with the ballistic missiles. I'm not sure the degree to which anyone can fully prepare for that, but the fact that the U.S. response has been so thorough, I think it's pretty impressive. Those commercial ships that have taken hits, you know, you can only do so much. There's geometry involved here in how one defends ships, and you know, that becomes a math and physics challenge that hasn't been figured out yet.
Yeah, your U.S. naval ships, how'd they not sort of run out of ammunition and rockets to kind of counter that threat? Because it seems to be a large volume of things going on out there.
Well, there is a very deliberate dialogue happening now about do we have the right weapon systems in place for this defense. The Navy has been working on for years directed energy weapons, for both lasers and microwave systems that are probably much better suited for this type of threat. So we are firing fairly expensive missiles at fairly inexpensive threats. But in doing so, we are protecting multi-billion dollar ships and the lives on board. So I think that's a false debate right now about we fire a $2 million missile at a $20,000 threat. It's always going to be an expensive defensive system. But the Navy has known that it needed to move into directed energy. I think we're seeing a rapid acceleration now. Not coincidentally, in January, the head of the U.S. Navy Surface Forces at the Surface Navy Association annual symposium said it very bluntly. We've been working on this for 10 years. It's time to accelerate this. And to his credit, he doesn't own the budget and all the budgeting decisions associated with it, but he's responsible for those ships that are forward deployed. The budgeting process that gets us to those decisions is incredibly complex, and there are all sorts of competing factors that can delay or accelerate which systems get the investment.
The Houthis seem to have some quite sophisticated equipment. It seems to be sort of drones and certain types of missiles. Do we know where they're kind of getting that from?
There's no doubt that Iran is supporting them. I think there's two aspects to it. One is the flow of funding that allows for it to happen. The other is the flow of technology and the sharing of information. There are reports of an Iranian ship or ships supporting with targeting information. I will say to pinpoint a specific target at sea requires highly sophisticated integrated capability. I think we've seen probably the peak of what the Houthis have available to them in terms of sophistication, but you don't do that sort of targeting without high quality data. And so they clearly have access to that. What are we doing about that, I think, is a fair question. Vice Admiral Brad Cooper, the former Fifth Fleet commander, was on 60 Minutes in a fairly open conversation about the fact that the U.S. could certainly do more to Iran to stop this. But that's not a military decision. That's a political decision. And I comment to others about the stated concern that we don't want this to grow into a broader conflict. I contend we've been in a broader conflict for quite some time now. We have U.S. forces in most Middle East countries for a variety of reasons. Syria, Jordan, Iraq, Kuwait, Afghanistan, Pakistan, UAE, Horn of Africa. I mean, we have a presence there, and in various ways, we have been subject to dozens, if not now hundreds, of attacks across many of these countries. So we're already in a broader conflict. We're just not calling it such, and I think we should be calculating differently. What would the impact be if we escalated with Iran to send a more clear message? And that could take a number of forms. You know, if we were to sink an Iranian ship that we suspect is targeting, that's a pretty loud signal, much like Ukraine has done with Russia. That's a serious cost to any country. It takes years to rebuild that capability, and it could send a signal. That's just one example.
Yeah. With that Iranian spy ship, I believe it suffered an electronic attack not long ago. Was that like a kind of warning, because it might next time be shot at by something sort of more sort of fatal, should we say?
Yeah, I don't claim to have direct knowledge of that particular situation, but it's not uncommon for the U.S. to signal things in such a way that hey, we've got your number. We we can do this any time of day. So tread carefully.
Yeah. And what options are there to deal with that ship? Are there ways to sort of jam it and so on, and, you know, sort of stop its sort of abilities without having to necessarily resort to sinking it?
Certainly. Ideally, we could affect it in port before it went to sea. And you know, certainly those sorts of plans are always in consideration. So I have served in the J3 of the Joint Staff, where global operations are considered. I've been a part of military planning at the theater level and at the operational level. And those sort of options are always on the table. How could we send a signal and prevent this from ever escalating? That could still happen. Those ships have to return to port at some time. There are ways to disable ships with electronic means, with means to impact their propulsion. Those would be soft kill sort of options, to use a term of art there. It's not always about the kinetic and sinking them to the bottom, but the morale impact of sinking a ship is unmistakable. That can send a much stronger signal that is irrefutable.
Yeah. You were talking a few moments ago about the situation could spiral with Iran. So I suppose my thought is sort of, what options are there on the table that can both send a direct signal to Iran, but not necessarily let things sort of spiral to a point where it leads to a full head-on-head conflict with them?
Well, I've been in the room leading congressional delegations in the UAE, where people who run banks were told fairly directly hey, we understand what's happening here. And we know you understand what's happening here. There are ways to freeze assets that can have an incredibly debilitating effect. I think we have been a bit schizophrenic with our approach to those sort of tools. There are further steps that could be taken where when you do cut off the flow of funding, things slow down dramatically.
Indeed. I was thinking about the Falklands War, where Britain used MI6 to sort of buy up the Exocet missiles that were being used to shoot at British ships. And I don't know if there's any options on the table to somehow disrupt the weapons supply or buy up the weapons that the Houthis might want or want to use.
Yeah, you know, I think that's actually a reasonable diplomatic tool. And some may not see that as diplomacy, but it's not much different than us distributing cash on the ground in Afghanistan or Iraq to win friends and influence people. That is a tool that we are uniquely able to execute. The degree to which those sort of plans are ever discussed openly, you might hear it anecdotally. I don't claim direct knowledge of interaction with the CIA. I think it is generally understood that our special operations forces are intertwined with various paramilitary operations, and that's as designed, and there is a specific law that controls how that's done. But those sort of activities can shape the battlefield, so to speak.
Yeah. So one interesting question is, how do we balance of long-term geostrategic and diplomatic goals in the Middle East with short-term immediate needs to, when it comes to dealing with the Houthis?
Yeah, you're hitting on what I think is the problem of our times. Certainly from a U.S. perspective, we seem to have lost sight of what we think our place in the world should be. Mm. I say we as the citizens of the United States. The government, I believe, generally feels that it has a leadership position, and then there are debates about how to exercise that leadership. But there is a growing portion of our population that is less well-informed about the history of the post-World War II world order, such that they may have lost some of the connection to why some of these relationships and alliances came about to begin with. And so it might look easy to save money by not spending on some of these things that cost a lot of money and pulling back to be more isolationist. The cost of that is that the vacuum will fill. There aren't other countries who have the resources to be able to be forward deployed and to be as ever present as the U.S. has grown to be. It's just a function of the resources and our method of government that has brought us to this place. But we have a growing portion of the population that questions that position in the world order, and we may find ourselves relearning lessons that were painfully learned in the 30s and 40s.
Yeah, indeed. It does seem there's sort of a disconnect these days. In the UK, and when I grew up, we kind of traditionally have seen the US sort of as the policeman of the world. I don't know if that's the best way to put it, but certainly Europe is very dependent on American support. And I feel like a lot of people sort of, I don't know if it's my generation or younger, have sort of lost touch with that sort of sense of responsibility. I feel like there's some sort of push back against that idea.
Well, in general, Americans don't travel abroad. In general, it's a minority that do. And it is a fact that the majority of Americans don't read a single book in a given year. They don't complete a single book in a given year. I had the good fortune to travel extensively as a congressional liaison around the world. I've been to over 60 countries. It has enhanced my perspective of what options are out there. Something that is sort of seared in my mind are the multiple visits to American Battle Monuments cemeteries that exist across Europe. And when we would go to those cemeteries where American dead are buried on foreign soil, those communities around the cemetery, they remember vividly what that experience was about. And we're losing them, but there are people still living who shed tears describing the story of what their life was like in those moments. You know, I pray that we don't have to revisit that, but I fear it's a possibility if the U.S. were to disengage. You know, I think there's some very loose talk about who pays the bill for NATO and why that's important to us, it's to me it's just silliness and ignorance of how it came about.
Yeah, indeed, and I think. I wonder if the sort of drawdown after the Cold War in the 1990s, a lot of sort of wrapping up of like bases in Europe and things, has led people to a false sense of complacency and feeling that peace is a given. Because I don't think nowadays, I don't feel like peace is a given at all.
I think there was a false message that took hold that there could be a peace dividend. That the wall came down and we had won against those forces, and now we can focus on our domestic concerns. Mm-hmm. And it's just not the way the world works. And unfortunately, we've made some strategic blunders. The movement in response to 9/11 by the U.S. Forces to move from chasing down Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan to suddenly saying we need to go to Iraq. Mm. That was a huge strategic blunder that cost us 20 years and trillions of dollars. And worse, it chipped away at Americans' confidence in their government to make sound decisions on the global stage. And so 2 decades of war has affected multiple generations of citizens and how they view what the U.S. position should be in the world.
Yeah, and I really think the Gulf War, the Second Iraq War, very much fed into anti-Americanism, which I think then countries like Russia have been able to capitalize on with disinformation efforts. And I think it's a real shame because those disinformation efforts are now really influencing maybe people younger than myself these days.
The speed and quantity of information, good and bad, that moves around the world has accelerated some of these problems. No doubt about it. It's very difficult to understand on one level and control in another level. And unfortunately, the United States has a tremendous capacity to overestimate its capabilities to influence and shape things. There are other very bright people around the world who also know how to use technology and capabilities or bring about capabilities. And you know, sometimes we just have this false sense of superiority that we've got the right answer, and why wouldn't everybody want the answer that we want?
Yeah.
And it just doesn't work that way.
Yeah. One wider question. You were talking about travel and the importance of it earlier. Do you think that sort of travel and worldliness is a key to kind of maybe getting past some of that sort of mentality of people's day sort of falling for foreign propaganda?
I think it can help. Mm. I don't know exactly how to get at that one. I will say that opportunities for military service are what allowed it for me. For many people in the United States, as well off as we are, it's not seen as something that many can afford to do. Certainly not on the scale that I've been able to through my government work. It requires a commitment. Requires a level of effort and resources that many people don't prioritize. It doesn't mean that you can't learn it through books or other forms of video entertainment, documentaries, for example. But we tend to self-select to the easiest and quickest thing. Mm. And we now in this, you know, day of social media, our attention span is so short that to sit down to learn something new, that takes real discipline.
And yeah, no, indeed. Well, just drawing a little bit on your experience of the Navy, it'd be remiss of me not to ask you about what it's like being on a naval ship in a situation, you know, dealing with missiles coming in at you and trying to sort of counter threats, and also what it's like to be in the command of a ship like that. You know, what is sort of the day-to-day sort of processes like in those sort of situations?
Yeah, there are a few layers to that. So I don't pretend to have endured the type of threat environment that the ships are in right now. I have in a synthetic manner, which is how we prepare for these things, to be able to deal with the decision making apparatus. But a couple of points about ship life and command. Ships operate in a very structured way. Mm. There's a place for everything. Everything's in its place. There are procedures that are followed. There is training at the individual level, at the group level, at a ship level, at a multi ship level, and at a battle group level. So you spend a lot of time training on how to do things a correct way.
Mm.
There's a right way, a wrong way, and the Navy way. And it's imperative that people understand and be qualified for the positions, for the roles that they're in. And there are ways to create methods of interchangeability. But a ship runs 24 hours a day. It provides its own power. It provides its own water. It has to be replenished with fuel and provisions periodically, but it's a 24-hour operation where there's a watch team driving the ship. There's a watch team responsible for weapon systems. The captain is always on watch, but never standing a watch, so to speak. And so, you know, for me, the day would start, you know, between 6 and 7 a.m., and it would go until 11 at night. Typically, depending on what evolutions were happening, I may get calls through the night from watch teams, you know, they have certain parameters within which they make decisions. There are some things that are command decisions. There are very, very, very few instantaneous command decisions that have to be made. But the ships that are out there right now in the Red Sea are facing many of those instantaneous decisions. So they are typically trying to control the battle space with time, and time is what allows for a decision to take place. And so you can get your decision timelines pretty darn tight, you know, down to seconds, where there are you know, sort of go no go decisions. And so I mentioned parameters. There can be parameters set where the captain doesn't have to be in the combat information center to signal an authorization to fire a weapon. In defense, the tactical action officer is there to make that decision. But that round-the-clock nature of operations can be quite tiring over time. And so sleep management is an issue. Fatigue is an issue. Periodically, you know, ships do need to sort of take a break and come offline for a couple of days. What we're facing right now, we talked about weapons earlier. These vertically launched weapons do require going ashore to replace them in large numbers. So this is public information. The destroyers have you know, over 90 missiles on board. But if you're shooting dozens, it doesn't take long before you get to that 50% threshold where we typically would be looking for where's the next round coming from. Those ships in the Red Sea are going over to Gibraltar to get reloaded. So if you do the math there, it's about 20 hours to transit the Suez Canal. It's 3 days to cross the Mediterranean, 2 days to reload, 3 days to come back, 20 hours. Suddenly you've burned a week going offline to go reload. And so that logistics tail becomes problematic. And so the Navy would like to get out of that. When the ships were designed, it was thought that those missiles could be reloaded at sea. That proved to be inherently unsafe, and the Navy has not done it ever. There are systems being developed that will allow for shorter timelines, because that scenario I just painted for the Mediterranean, if you take that to the Pacific, the numbers are much, much bigger.
Mm.
And it's it's weeks to cross the Pacific. And we don't have those missiles pre-positioned everywhere. They're in certain key locations that most people could figure out. I'm giving you maybe more than you wanted, but
that's good. I like it.
The typical daily routine is it's a full day. The crew is on a watch rotation, usually three sections, meaning four on, eight off. That's enough where you can typically get 5 hours of sleep there at a single time, which is that's pretty good. There are collateral duties associated with most sailors on board. They have responsibility for something other than just standing watch.
Yes. Yeah. Things got to be polished and cleaned and so on.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there's a reason for the cleanliness issue, and most ships are quite clean. I think anybody would be proud to walk aboard a warship from any country. You typically see the same thing. That's just good order and discipline, and health standards demand that. I loved it. I entered the Navy thinking I would spend 4 years, and I spent 24. Mm. It was incredibly exciting and fulfilling work, and I loved the discipline and the structure of it, and wouldn't have traded it.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. One question actually just popped into my head. We were talking about cleanliness just now, and I was just thinking of, I think it was the... Was it the sinking of the Moskova? And there was some speculation about that certain standards in the Russian Navy weren't being adhered to about, I think it was fire safety that might have led to the ship sinking, basically.
Yeah, we've understood this about the Russian Navy and the Soviet Navy before it, that what they lack is an enlisted force of leadership that... the U.S. and the British Navy have, and there are other Western navies that have this as well. But that enlisted force of technical skill that also has leadership abilities makes a tremendous difference in the ability to have a top-down structure of continuity in how things are done, and when the crunch is on, the command and control is there to support what's needed. When things are centralized and only the boss can make decisions, then people are not empowered and they don't take the initiative and they don't learn and they're afraid to act. And so it's very evident when you look at video of how that ship responded to an incoming threat. And we've seen it multiple times now with the unmanned surface vessel attacks. There's no defensive posture. And so other people learn from that. Other nations learn from that. We see, wow, they really aren't nearly as ready as one would think. Mm. And this has been an issue, I think, with many of our adversaries in the past. We used to refer to the 10-foot Russians. They're so big and powerful until we figured out they weren't. I think we're making similar assessments of the Chinese capability right now. They are not the same as the Russians, but they're not 10 feet tall. Our concern about escalating with Iran, Iran is not 10 feet tall. There are no 10-foot tall Iranians. These problems can be approached, but sometimes I think we need to use that sort of fear factor to help drive resources and protect resources on certain programs. Our U.S. Defense Department budget is $850 billion a year. There are a lot of other interests that would like to get a piece of that. And we had this ongoing debate for the last 15 years in the U.S. about defense versus non-defense spending. And there are legitimate concerns about domestic issues and social programs and other ways that money could be spent. Mm. But it does come at a cost to the international position and our national security.
Indeed, and those are important things. Well, let's take a quick break and then we'll be right back. A wider question. So we've seen, especially with Ukraine, an increased use of drones, and obviously with the Houthis as well, and they've had a devastating effectiveness against naval and civilian ships. And I was wondering what you may think the future of the US Navy is sort of looking like now in the age of the drone.
Warfare is changing before our eyes, no doubt about it. And it has been. We just haven't been able to see it as readily. And by that, I mean cyber warfare is with us and has been with us for decades now. There are things that happen that we never are told about that may shape behaviors and outcomes. That is a non-lethal way to send signals. Recognition of we now politely call them uncrewed vehicles. The recognition that uncrewed underwater vehicles and uncrewed surface vessels are a less expensive way to move forward. We've been working, the U.S. Navy has been working for some time to integrate autonomous underwater vehicles and uncrewed underwater vehicles with our subsea domain efforts. You know, we have a very robust submarine capability. But we initially wanted to see that we could integrate those UUVs and AUVs with that environment. Control of water space is a particular challenge because you don't have all of the visual cues that you do in the air. The Navy moved quickly, trying to ask Congress for a lot of money a few years ago, and Congress said, hey, show us your plan before we're just going to throw money at this. We don't want to start a program that's not ready. The Navy stepped back. They sort of developed a concept of ops. That's unfolding now, and we're seeing production. This week, I'm at home in Florida today, but I was just in D.C. For the Sea Air Space Symposium, the largest maritime symposium in the world. There's no doubt that uncrewed is the future. And it's happening underwater and on the surface. All sorts of smaller surface drones are being developed. We learned during the wars in the Middle East that we could arm a Predator drone in the air. That was a precursor to some of these things that we are now figuring out what sort of payloads need to be on what sort of trucks, for lack of a better word. But it's just a matter of what are the capabilities that we need. Is it a sensor? Is it a weapon? Is it just a surveillance or presence? And those things are now being very well integrated.
Yeah. I may be wrong here, but I think, is it the Zamolt class ship, which was this sort of experimentation with a sort of a stealth ship, but with more autonomy. Is that right?
The Zumwalt class. Zumwalt, yeah. Named after a former chief of naval operations.
Yeah, I've read there's been some sort of controversy around that type of ship, and some people are saying it's become a waste of money. I don't know, sort of what your thoughts and insight on that type of ship are in sort of the current Navy strategy.
Well, there were to have been more of them. At the time when the cost of the ship started to escalate to be above $3 billion per ship, that was at the time deemed to be an outrageous sum of money. And we made a mistake by thinking that we could move more quickly by bringing innovation to a platform before it was fully ready. There's a term for that. It's escaping me right now. But we now insist that capabilities be ready to be brought forward to a platform. It's not so funny, but today an Arleigh Burke destroyer costs over $2 billion. So that $3 billion figure seems almost quaint. We have figured out some things to do with this ship, some of which involves use of an electric gun, so to speak, where you can fire weapons very far inland from very far offshore in a way that a traditional gun could not do. There are other weapon systems being demonstrated. It is a ship that has far fewer sailors on board than a traditional ship. But we've been experimenting with that for a number of years with the littoral combat ship, the two variants of that ship class. That was a troubled program, but there was learning that took place about what's required to operate a ship. When you introduce technology and various levels of autonomy, you can reduce the numbers required. It will never be what a commercial ship is, where you can run a supertanker with, you know, fewer than 20 people. It won't be that because there are too many other mission sets required along the way, besides just getting from point A to point B.
Thank you for that. So if you were in a situation where, you know, you were in a position of authority where you could sort of deal with the Houthi situation, what do you think could or should be done to counter the Houthis that currently isn't being done?
I've been puzzled that the senior diplomat for the U.S. is too often our CIA director. If you look at who's doing the real negotiating in Gaza and the Hamas situation, it's Bill Burns. I understand he's a particularly skilled individual, but he's not the Secretary of State. And I think we are firefighting with our diplomacy right now. That's how it appears to me. It doesn't mean that there aren't communications happening at the local level with ambassadors, but they convey a different level of gravitas than does the president's most senior cabinet secretary.
Yeah.
So I think diplomacy, there's certainly more that could be done. I think we have been a little erratic in our engagement with Iran. With in the Obama administration, we handed over $1 billion in cash. Where we thought that was going to go, who knows? That was an effort to do something different, and I think it failed. I've talked about the flow of funds. I think the access to the SWIFT system is something that could be more rigidly controlled. We see Russia still has pretty ready access to that system. In terms of direct kinetic strikes at Iran, I don't think that's what we're talking about here. But if you were to sink a ship or take out a capability that matters, that does send a signal. Now, we took out a terrorist leader a few years ago, and some would say that was stirring the hornet's nest. Well, if you want to get rid of the hornets, you do have to stir the nest.
Yeah.
and so there, we have not in the U.S. Prepared the citizenry to understand why this matters. And we've talked about some of the more peaceful reasons that in the big picture, we want these things to take place. We want commerce, we want security. We have to make people understand that you have to make Americans understand why does this matter to me? I don't think we're doing well at that sort of strategic messaging.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there anything that could be done that would improve that strategic messaging, do you think, or improve that understanding?
Well, I'm not wild about commenting on our two choices for who might be president, but we have a system in place that allows less than the best to advance to the final round, and that's frustrating. And it works its way down at the local level, state and even county level in the United States. And some of these decisions about who can even be on a ballot and how does one get there, to me, it's a bit murky. And I'm a PhD in public policy and I've studied political science and I teach public policy at a university. But the average citizen does not have that understanding of how the ballot process works for someone to even advance. There's a perception that it's just about money and whoever can raise the most money will advance. That's one part of the challenge. So we need to have better people in government, more thoughtful people in government, who are participating in some of these decisions. And frankly, we have some fairly uninformed people in fairly senior positions who are able to exercise influence over outcomes that is beyond their understanding.
Mm.
And until that changes, and in our country, that changes with votes, but until that changes, we will continue to revisit this.
Yeah. Well, last question, really. Is there anything else that's important to you that you would like to add before we wrap up today?
Well, I work in an area of government now. I advise defense companies in how to best serve the government customer, and I help them get to dramatic outcomes by my understanding of a very complex process. I've had exposure to it from multiple perspectives as an active duty officer working at senior levels. In DOD, as a corporate lobbyist working for a large defense company. Mm. And for the last 10 years, I've been advising smaller defense companies who don't necessarily have that access to the same information. I mentioned I teach public policy. I'm an adjunct professor at Florida State. And I believe very strongly that we need people to aspire to serve in government. We need very smart and dedicated people to aspire to serve in government, not just the elected positions, but the unelected positions. It takes committed people to support a government and to work in it and to fully participate. And I fear that there's a generation that may be getting a bad taste of what that could be like, and why that maybe it doesn't pay as well as you could make in a higher tech job, or something where you're more directly involved in innovation. We tend to promote the making of money as early as you can, in as big a number as you can, as the key to success. And I think most of the wealthiest people would say that's not really what they think makes them successful. But it's a challenge. So, what would I like to see? As I'm a 61-year-old man who's been at this for a while now. I hope that our following generations can see that there's a need for them to participate in whatever way, whether it's just being an informed voter or participating in government. There are opportunities to make a difference, and we don't have to wait for some external force to rally us to that call for duty.
Mm, indeed. External force being a foreign power or alien power, if you look at some movies we have out these days.
or AI. Right?
Or AI, yes. Well, thank you so much for your time today. Where can listeners find out more about you and your work?
Well, thanks for that, Chris. I've enjoyed the conversation. I have a website, genemoran.com. And it talks all about my work, my books. I speak to a lot of different groups. If people would like me to speak, I have sort of a side role in explaining and interpreting what's happening for people, and try to make it understandable as to why some of these things matter at a more local level. But it's all there, and I'm happy to communicate with anybody.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for your time today.
You bet. Good to be here.
Listening. This is Secrets and Spies.